There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Hi, guys. Nerdist Podcast number 340. All right, I'm on the road now, officially. So come out to Caroline's and see me in New York. I will be there the 6th through the 8th of April. And then after that, I will be in Madison, Wisconsin, and then bopping around to other cities like Austin for the Moon Tower Festival, and then Denver and Portland and D.C. and Baltimore and London on May 15th and I believe the 16th as well. And then in Utah later on. So go to Nerdist.com/calendar. Come on out. And if you watch Nerdist TV show this weekend and Talking Dead, thank you. I mean, even if you watch them individually in one and not the other, I still thank you. And if you thought about it but you didn't do it, thanks. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, LegalZoom. LegalZoom has been serving people for over 12 years. You can get powers of attorney, personalized wills, living trusts, real estate documents, and more. And they can help maintain businesses with incorporation and LLC filings, trademarks, copyrights. And they have great customer service. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they can connect you to an attorney and provide self-help services at your specific direction. For even more savings, enter Nerdist in the referral box at checkout if you're a parent or entrepreneur. Don't wait. Call or visit LegalZoom.com and protect what's yours. Speaking of protecting what's theirs, this is actually not a bad segue. The guest on this podcast has been on so many fucking phenomenal things. I met him doing House of a Thousand Corpses, and we've just been pals over the years, and I've really enjoyed watching his success. He won an Oscar for a short right after we did House of a Thousand Corpses. It's like you work with someone, you're like, oh, that guy's really cool. Hey, why are they in the Academy Awards? Oh, shit, they just won an Oscar. That's Walton Goggins. And then he's been on just some of the most amazing stuff. Like, he was on The Shield. He was on Sons of Anarchy. He was in Django Unchained, Lincoln. He's now currently on Justified. He plays Boyd Crowder. And he's a friggin' good actor. And a great dude. And again, a lot of these podcasts are me scheduling time to catch up with people that I haven't talked to in a long time. Did my voice just crack? I think my voice just cracked. First those weird hairs, and now this. But Walton is a delightful man, and I'm glad we got a chance to sit down and talk. It makes me think, hey, maybe I should hang out with people socially. What would that be like? What if it wasn't just work-driven? Like, I actually just called someone and said, hey, I'm not going to record this conversation. Let's just go have a meal and talk about our lives. But then if it gets really good, I'll probably want to turn the iPhone microphone on and capture something. You know, some of this is documenting things. And then that way there's sort of like an audio diary of the last 3 years of catching up with people and getting to know people. So it's not entirely crazy that I'm doing this. But I believe this is a particularly good episode. So here you go. Nerdist Podcast number 340 with Walton Goggins.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We've got tonight. Who needs tomorrow? We've got tonight to prepare.
Why don't you stir?
Okay, so Walton Goggins has gone to the end of the hall because we did not want to start talking until the show was recording so that we wouldn't waste an ounce.
Am I being recorded now?
This is it. We're in it. And
we're
I appreciate the fact
we're in
that...
It. We're in it.
I appreciate the fact that you took the lead on that and you're like, I don't think we should start talking until the podcast starts recording.
I'm just protecting your audience, man. I want it to be fresh. I want this to be fresh.
It's
going to
be fresh. Right out of the bag, we're not going to have to repeat things we talked about and make it seem
at
new.
All. We could repeat a hug that we had, a physical manifestation of our friendship.
That's right, but no one would be able to hear that. So
no one would be able to hear that. So we're hugging right now.
This is a long, awkward hug. I wanted to let go at first, but now I don't want to let go. I'm just going to let it happen.
We can share the same mic.
This is. I'm just holding a mic behind your back. And we'll just do a hug cast. We'll
if
just
it was
do a
Boyd
little...
Crowder, that would be a knife. Or Shane Mandrell, it would be a gun.
It's good to see you.
I
don't, you know, we first met doing House of a Thousand Corpses.
We did.
Which you know, but I'm telling the people from the podcast. And so, you know, I don't really know you super well, but we've been pals and acquaintanced for, you know, 13 years or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think if you're in a Rob Zombie movie, man, you bond because you spend, you know, the better part of a month running from people that want to kill you. So
in really horrible ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was really interesting. I mean, everybody kind of had their own thing on that movie, and we talked, but we didn't have a chance to really kind of hang out. And you do a movie in Los Angeles, then you're not on location.
And you were in different scenes because you were a different, you know, like I was
the lead. You were the lead.
No, Chris. I was one of four. I was one of four people who
with Rain,
with
right?
Rain
and Aaron, right?
Yeah, and Rain and Aaron and Jen, Justin, yeah. And so we had our own little cluster because that was we did all our scenes together.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and then you were off.
I was a cop. I was a police officer. It was funny, man. I had a
you're with
a really,
Tom.
Really good time.
What was that guy's name?
Yeah, Tom.
He was really funny.
He's really funny. He's a wonderful actor too. He's a wonderful actor. But I had really really big sideburns.
Yep.
Those we kind of, kind of grew those out for a while. But, you know, the thing, I mean, there were so many things about that experience. I don't know how you felt with that experience, but, you know, I did not know what to expect kind of meeting Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Like, really, I thought, okay, I need some money. Like, I need a little money. It's a Rob Zombie movie. I don't know Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. It's 6 weeks. I work a day a week. I love that schedule.
Great.
And I'm getting paid for 6 weeks. You know what? I'll do it. I was 26 years old.
Oh, wow.
27. I mean, maybe I was 28. I don't know. It was like 13 years ago,
yeah.
Chris. It
yeah.
was a long time ago.
It was a
ago.
Long time ago. Well,
yeah.
I
but then I showed up and met him and knew, like, in 15 seconds, it's like, wow, that dude, Rob Zombie, is special, man.
He's a great dude. Well, the reason that I was in the movie is because I've been friends with Rob since 95.
Have you really?
Yeah. And yeah. So no one would have ever cast me in a movie. He basically just wrote the part for me and put me in it because I never auditioned for film. It's not like I just don't do, you know. And so it was because he called and he was like, hey, I think I'm going to direct a movie. Do you want to be in it? And I was like, sure. So that's how I got involved in it.
Wow.
So I've known him for a long time and people always think like, I was a crazy rock star. And you're like, he's one of the most kind of even keeled, cool.
Cool,
insightful,
even smart, insightful. He knows his audience.
Yeah,
he's so visually artistic. His kind of visual acumen.
Yeah,
like how he takes. I mean, because I had never gone to a Rob Zombie show, you know, before this. Now
yeah.
I've gone to five, and like seeing his audience and like the journey that he takes him on during his concert, because it's so visual. You know, there's so many set
yeah.
pieces, so many things are happening. That's the same way that he directs a movie. There was one shot in particular. I don't know. It's still one of the favorite shots that I've ever participated in any movie. And yeah, the gunshot to the
like
head, the
30 second long.
Yeah, it was more. It was almost two minutes.
Oh wow!
It's almost 2 minutes. It's the length of this entire song, and it was so cold that day, and there were rocks I had, like, you know, like, sit on my knees, like I was on my knee, and I was hurting, and it was cold. There was a gun to my head, and he kept going back, and he kept going back, and I was, like, you know, scared. I was, like, hyperventilating, and I thought, man, if he does this one more time, I really am going to die. and it blew my mind, and I have, I don't know, like, I'd say three big writer friends of mine, Academy Award nominated writers, that's still one of their favorite scenes.
Really?
One guy in particular, Dan Waters, who wrote Heathers and Batman or whatever, like the list goes on and on. He played that on a loop in his house before I met him. And it was like, wow, that's cool.
It's a cool scene because this, you know, like the juxtaposition of like the song versus what's going on.
Yeah.
But then the song just ends and it just keeps going and going and going and going.
Unbelievable, buddy. That's called tension.
That was a fair amount of tension. And then after, not too long after House of a Thousand Corpses, watching the Oscars one night, Walton Goggins. What? And then you fucking win an Academy Award for a short film.
It's crazy, man. It was a crazy experience. You know, my partners and I, Ray McKinnon and his wife, his late wife, one of my best friends, Lisa Blunt, both actors, and Lisa was nominated for a Golden Globe for Officer and a Gentleman, been around forever, and Ray had been around forever at that time. You know, he's a real character actor, and he had written this short film, you know, and he said, would you be in it? And it was kind of after The Apostle. It's like, well, you know, okay, sure, I'll read it. And then I read it and was just blown away by it. And it was like 35 pages long. It was really a featurette, not a short. And you know, during the discussions that we had kind of leading up to it, we found out that we had a lot in common, you know. And he was an old friend of mine. I'd known him since I was 16 years old. And we both wanted to make movies. And so they kind of invited me in, and we formed this company, Jenny Mule Pictures, and started with this short film. You know, never thinking that I didn't even know about that the Academy Awards had a category really for short film. I just didn't think about it.
Right.
All the times that you kind of watch, you know, that broadcast, and I was actually, oddly enough, doing the pilot of The Shield, and Chiklis said, "Oh, you did a short. You should submit it for an Academy Award."
Is that how it happened?
Yeah, I'm gonna do that right now. I mean, they were, you know, Ray and Lisa kind of knew about it. I really didn't. We didn't really talk about it too much. And I said, you know what? Hey, guys, this deadline's kind of coming up. This guy that I just worked with, Michael Chiklis, said that they take short films. You know, I mean, it was crazy. But we didn't do it. We did it, you know, as a calling card, and we wanted to make movies. And it was an unbelievable ride. You know, people really responded to it. And it gave us the opportunity to make, you know, three movies, three full-length features that I'm very, very, very proud of.
So let's just talk, first of all, about the experience of going to the Academy Awards, because you're basically, you're nominated, so you absolutely deserve to be there. But at that time in your career, you're certainly not as known as the people that you're sitting with at the Academy Awards, and then you're getting up in front of everyone. And
it was so weird, man. Like how the whole thing kind of went down. I mean, we were 2 years, or I think I had just finished the first season of The Shield, you know, when it happened. So we were there, and we get this nomination that morning. You know, it's like when they announced. They didn't announce our names. You had to look online. We found out like 10 minutes later, you know, like looking through things online. It's like, oh my God, we're nominated. And then, you know, that month, that just honeymoon period of that experience, it's like, oh my, what an incredible experience. Even on this level, even for a short film, it's an unbelievable experience to know that you're in that company of artists. And then we got a call from CNN, who wanted to do a document, like a mini kind of documentary on us, like on this kind of short film thing, right? This category. It's like, who are these people? These people look interesting. Oh, we want to follow those guys. So they kind of came, and part of the whole kind of following was that we had to get to the they had to follow us to the Academy Awards, right? To the actual ceremony. And we only had one interview for E, oddly enough, on the red carpet. That's the only one that our publicist could guarantee us. And the only way that we could get it is if we got there before every single person.
Of course.
So literally, we showed up at the Academy Awards all the people were outside. They hadn't even all kind of arrived, like all the fans and stuff. We were the first limo to pull up, and people went apeshit. People lost their mind. And then the door opened and we stepped out and the air went out of the room. It was like no one even took a picture. They had their cameras up and then they put their cameras down.
Sure.
And then we had to wait for them to assemble the metal detectors before we even got on the red carpet. So we're just sitting there hanging out, exhausted, like at 1 o'clock or 12:30, whatever.
Sure.
And make our way onto the red carpet. And finally kind of go through, did our one interview. People heard us. People really liked us. We wound up doing 100 interviews, every single person.
Oh,
all
shit.
Over the world. It was one after another. They were like, good luck, guys. Good luck.
That's
good
really
luck.
Cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And then, and then I had listened to kind of KCRW, a report on NPR like a week before. And they said, if they think you're going to win, they'll sit you on the aisle so that you can kind of get up there quicker. And we, got into the building, and it was the first year in the Kodak Theater. Walked in, and we were dead center, man. We were right in the middle of the aisle.
They're like, this probably isn't going to happen.
Yeah, and I looked at my friends, and I said, look, man, it is kind of what it is, and let's just enjoy this experience. And I was sitting next to Enya. So that was awesome. That was enough. That was worth the price of admission. And then you know, we're sitting there and we forget that we're even nominated at one point because, you know, the people that were winning that year oh my God, now I'm the asshole on your show who can't remember the most important African-American actor of all time that they were honoring that year.
Sidney Poitier.
And Sidney was so eloquent and so beautiful. There's not a dry eye in the room. And our category was up after that. And we looked at each other and said, well, we're not going to win anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But how do you follow that? Who wants to go on after Sidney Poitier had that speech? No one. What would you do? And then they kind of came up, you know, afterwards and called out the names, and it was us. And it was unbelievable. And we walked up on stage, and the faces that you're looking at, you know, these seminal kind of artists in the pantheon of artists in this business doing what they do. And Owen Wilson was a friend of mine, or is a friend of mine. And he was there in the audience, and he just went, what the fuck?
Hey, man, what are you guys doing up there?
That's my bad, Owen Wilson. You probably have an Owen Wilson. You must have an Owen Wilson.
Man. Yeah.
Hey, man. That was really, really good job up there, man.
I have a pretty good Sam Rockwell.
Oh, what's your Sam Rockwell?
Hey, man. Thanks, man.
Hey, Sam, you're getting all weird now, Sam. Why do you keep thanking me for something, man?
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks,
no, what
Owen.
Are you thanking me for?
I love that, man.
I didn't do anything.
I love
I'm just sitting here having an experience,
that's a good movie, man.
Oh, I didn't do anything yet. You mean the dog movie? It was sad. It was a sad movie.
No, yeah. The dog movie was just, that made me cry, man.
Was it Marley and Me?
That made me cry.
It was Marley and Me.
I read that book. Did you read that book? You read it.
I did not read the book.
You read the book?
No. I have trouble watching sad things. I'm empathetic to the point of almost being empathic, where I just absorb and I can't shake it. So if I watch a sad movie at night, it fucks me up so much.
Yeah.
That I can't go to bed.
So what do you do? Like, do you just like just go to superficial places and like eat superficial? Because like literally the world being kind of what it is today. Because I'm that way.
Yeah.
I don't know. You can't read a newspaper. You can't turn on the television. I can't even have a conversation with my wife, who's brilliant. This woman is so well informed, without feeling the way that you're talking about feeling. Like I it's like listening to the Carpenters, like in your head.
on a loop
all day long.
Long ago and oh so, let's turn on the news. Far away. I think my work schedule is such, and maybe this was subconsciously or not so subconsciously constructed by me, is that I don't have a lot of free time to sit around and think about stuff.
Yeah.
And then the other times I'm doing comedy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's right. So,
I mean, you know, I think a lot of it.
Is that how you deal with it? Is that how you kind of.
Sure.
Yes, that's how you deal with it.
That's how comics deal with it. I mean, it's, you know, we have to. I think if there wasn't comedy, I would say most comics would be clinically insane people. Like they would be fucked up.
Sunset and Vine.
Psychopaths,
man.
Sociopaths.
Yeah.
you know, like they would be, it's being able to, it's just our way of processing that information.
I think you could say the same thing about a lot of actors, man.
I guess so.
Honestly. You know, I mean, really, it's to kind of, you know, get this out, whatever this is, kind of in a constructive way and get paid for it. I mean, that's, you know, the best of both worlds, man. It's extremely cathartic to me because I'm the same way. I'm OCD. I live with a certain amount of anxiety that I've managed to kind of, you know, keep away or keep it low grade.
Sure, low grade. Yeah, that's a good way to sort of keep it. It's sort of like an app that runs in the background.
It is, yeah.
I'm sorry. It just sort of, it's always running in the background.
It's always there.
Or that you're always kind of like... you know, sometimes I look at it as borrowing against future happiness, where you're like, I'll put off the anxiety, I'll borrow some happiness from the future that's definitely gotta come, right?
Yeah.
And then I'll just, push it off to the side and push it off to the side. Yeah. And then, you know, every once in a while, it's like, time to pay this
time
check.
To pay it, yeah.
You know,
going back, I have to go back really quickly just to put a button on this Academy Award experience.
Yes.
So after that whole whatever that was on that stage and then going down to the bowels of the Kodak Theater, coming back up, having a drink, had a drink at the bar. Ethan Hawke was right there, had a drink, toasted him. Conversation. I have the trophy in my hand.
Holy shit.
And I'm, you know, walking around and I go back to enter the theater and I'm just looking down. I can't believe it. I'm just like, I'm in my head. And this, I hear this voice say, oh, wow, what did you win for? What did you win? I said, and I looked up and I said, a short film. It's called The Accountant. And she said, oh, well, congratulations. Hi, I'm your senator. I'm Barbara Boxer. I said, I know who you are, Barbara. I know who you are. And there was a guy off to the left that I didn't even see because I was looking at Barbara, and he just said, congratulations, mate. Right, it's beautiful. And it was Sting.
What?
Fucking Sting, man. And I was like, you're Barbara Boxer, and you're Sting.
Oh, man.
Oh, my. And I'm sitting here with an Academy Award in my hands, man. It was crazy.
Where's your guy's Academy Awards?
Yeah.
Meh. And then you just instantly turn into a dick.
Boom. Look at that. Just go play the guitar, man.
Hey,
go
write some legislation. Where's your award? Sting.
Roxanne, who? Man.
You just got stung, Sting. Fucker, and you fucking pop him in the face with the butt.
Boom.
The Academy
Award. It's yellow. It's a yellow jacket. Sting.
Somebody better call the police. Oh, wait. You hate each other.
Oh, my God.
Barbara Boxer, and then you throw a couple of jabs.
Box her, sting him.
That's right. what a missed opportunity, Walton.
Yeah.
What a missed opportunity that no one would have faulted you for because you had just won an Academy Award.
I could have gotten away with it, couldn't I?
If you're going to punch Sting, it's okay in the first 15 minutes after winning an Academy Award.
That's all. That's the grace period that you get.
That's what you get.
You can do almost anything.
Pretty much anything you want. Yeah.
Anything, yeah.
Pretty much anything you want in that moment. I mean, it's I couldn't even. I mean, it. I think your brain must check out for a second while you're up there because it's probably, I would imagine, a lot to process.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It's a lot. There's a lot going on, you know. But it's, you know, it's weird. My wife and I kind of talk about this about just the carnival of life. Right? Carnival.
Yep.
Celebrating life. And in New Orleans, we were talking about New Orleans and what they have there, all of the different things that they have that are festival seasons, you know, and sometimes they're twice in one week.
Right.
You know, they have carnival after carnival and they get to express themselves and the absurd kind of nature of the human existence.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about like, the award season in this city. You know, I mean, we have a lot of things in this city, but the award season kind of has its own magical kind of quality. For the rest of the world, yeah, if it sees it on television, if they give a shit.
Sure.
But in this city, even if you're not in this business, you know, you're really impacted by it. You kind of see the preparation for it, and you can kind of feel an energy kind of in this city.
That's a much nicer interpretation than what I think a lot of people have, which is like, whatever. Oh, this is some bullshit, these fucking Hollywood
But that's bullshit. Like, really, you know, I mean, you know, did that change my life? I don't know. Does it really change anyone's life beyond, like, the moment?
Sure.
Beyond what happens in the moment, maybe you get another movie or two movies after that. You know, there have been a lot of people that have won, best actor or best actress, and their careers have been what they've been. But in that moment, it was life changing.
Sure.
Having a child is life changing.
Right.
You know, really getting married or getting divorced or having someone die from, you know, cancer, that's life-changing.
Yeah.
It's not superficial to me. It's a celebration of what it is that we do.
Yeah, which, of course, I mean, and that's, artistic things are very difficult to quantify. And
you
so you we have sort of weird, warped ways of measuring things to go like, I guess I'm doing an okay job. Well, I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
How well did that thing do? Okay, yeah. I guess that people liked it. Oh, they didn't like it. Okay, I guess they didn't go so well. Oh, yeah. They're, you know, because it's very difficult to. I mean, I find, the people that seem the happiest are the ones that like everything's just kind of a, you know, like the Will Ferrells of the world. Like, I just kind of do whatever I want. Yeah. Oh, you want to celebrate that? Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Either way, I'm going to do this thing.
Yeah.
Doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously, I don't care how cynical of a person you are.
Yeah.
If you're standing on stage at the Academy Awards holding an Oscar,
pretty awesome,
you can't, there's going to be some part of you that's like, yeah, it's all right. It's pretty fucking okay.
It's pretty fucking cool.
It's pretty fucking cool up here.
I'm just saying right now. Pretty fucking cool. Really up here. Cool.
I've never been to the Oscars. Did the show feel long when
you're
sitting
in
it?
Oh, you're going to be hosting
the Oscars. I will not be hosting the Oscars ever.
5 years from now, you'll be hosting
the
Oscars.
No, I won't. I won't.
I know your empire, man.
It's not going
to
happen.
It's continuing to rise. Not even on the rise. It has risen and continuing to rise.
Even if I ever got to a place in my career where someone said, like, do you want to host the Academy Awards, which I really don't ever foresee happening, I would never do it because
what? No, yes, you would.
I wouldn't. It is a thankless job. Everyone, it now,
it's tough. It's
not, you know, even when you won your Academy Award, I feel like it wasn't as mean as it is now. No matter who hosts the Academy Awards, everyone's just waiting to be like, fuck that fucking piece of shit. He's this is the worst Oscars ever. Like, there's such rage against the Oscar host, and it's a difficult job because you have to be a traffic cop, you have to be entertaining, you have to be respectful, people have to respect you that you're doing it, like they have to, it has to make sense that you're doing it, and there's this weird kind of stasis that you would have to achieve that I think is nearly impossible because there's so many egos at play.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of the comedy of the Oscars is always watered down because everyone's too afraid of offending an ego.
Right. Yeah.
And so it's not, you know, so when someone does take a shot, like, you know, Seth or Chris Rock or whoever, then people are like, you know, like, oh,
come on, man.
Yeah. It's fun and it is serious and it's a big deal, but we shouldn't take it so fucking seriously.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your comment, but I don't know if I would ever be ready for that kind of, for what comes with that.
Yeah. 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 It's weird kind of being in a room or, you know, cause there's this strange kind of pecking order and like just in, I don't know, maybe plumbers have it. Like if you got a really good plumber, you got an all-star plumber, I don't know. But in this business, kind of what, you know, what we do, for me anyway, I presented an award this year at the WGA, for the WGA Awards, Best Documentary Category, right? Mm-hmm. And I walked in and I'm looking at all of these writers and all these wonderful actors kind of presenting and you know, I am where I am in my career and I'm very, very, very grateful for it. I have a good life. But I don't give myself permission to really improvise kind of outside of the box, you know, because
of
all of, well, I mean, just, I just wanted to go out there and I wanted to be, to say what they had written for me to say.
Sure.
Alter it a little bit.
Yeah.
And just kind of go off. I don't feel like I have permission to really infuse myself into the situation.
Oh, right.
Because there are, you know, this guy came up and said, hi, really, really nice to meet you. And I said, oh, my God, nice to meet you too, Mr. Gillespie, da-da-da-da-da. I'm sorry, I'm a writer. I said, I wrote Jaws. And I'm not, you know, it's like, oh, my God, this person.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really strange, man. There's some talented people in this world.
Well, that's a whole different kind of, a lot of things have to align for it to play. Like, you know, Will Ferrell's always great on those award shows because he's just, you know, he's sweet and fun and upbeat and fucks around and doesn't care, but is not disrespect. Like, there's very few people I think can really pull it off. But I think Tina Fey was smart to say she would never host the Academy Awards because she just doesn't want to.
Yeah.
Just doesn't want to deal with all the crap. But you won the Oscar and you did the shit. I mean, you've done a lot of really fucking awesome stuff. And Justified is great, too. I mean, to come off, you know, and I hope you do give yourself the sort of gift of taking some of the credit for that, that it's, you know, maybe sort of is there an insecure part of you that's like, oh, I'm so lucky. But you sort of made that luck. I mean, you don't go from. The Shield, okay, you could have been lucky to get the, but to get another show like Justified and then to make all these movies, I mean, that's pretty
it's good, man. I'm very, very, as with anything in life, at least for me, I try to, and it's not false humility either. It really is, I really truly am grateful for every experience that I've had. I've also worked really hard. I came here with $300 in my pocket. You know, I was 19. I left college to come out here.
From where?
And, from Georgia, from a little town right outside of Atlanta. And so, you know, I was in the desert for a really long time. I mean, I did The Apostle when I was 24.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that was really, Bobby really kind of gave me my shot. I've been working kind of before that, you know, in a number of movies, but really kind of small roles, you know, and so it has been hard won. The thing, I don't know if you feel this way, but you know, the thing for me as I've gotten older, I just enjoy it so much more. I really enjoy what I do for a living so much more. And the experience on The Shield, the experience in television in general, if you're working on something that you really care about, you get to go to work every day, you know, and do it. Just you get another at bat. And it's just another chance to dig deeper into the psyche of you know, the person that you're playing, and to really kind of create subtlety and nuance.
I know that I'm working on stuff that I should be working on when I get really bummed that it's about to end.
Absolutely.
And super excited when it's coming back.
Yeah.
And then, you know, then I know, that's when you kind of know, like, okay, I think I'm in the right thing. Oh, we only have two episodes left. Fuck. Yeah, oh, now we got to wait another, you know.
I know. And I had that every day on the Shield, really for 7 years. It wasn't a script that we all didn't read and walk outside of our trailers wherever we are almost at the same time, because as soon as we got the script, we'd say, okay, see you, bye. And like 60 minutes later, we would all walk out going, holy fuck. Oh my God. Are you really going to say that? Are you going to really just say that to him? Are you going to do that? And it was, you know, but it was, you know, at the end of that 7 year experience, what this guy, Shane, you know, went through and what they all, what Michael and what CC and Kenny Johnson, everybody went through. You know, I thought that you can't top that. You shouldn't look to top that. You know, what is it that you do next? You know, that experience was probably in a box that is very close to my heart, never to be repeated again, because you know, lightning really struck in that instance. I mean, we're all still really good friends. And then lo and behold, you know, 2 years later, the opportunity came to work on Justified. And as soon as I read this guy, Boyd Crowder, I mean, he was supposed to die, you know, in the pilot. It was just for one episode. But even that, like, when they kind of came and said, hey, would you do this? And I said no initially. And then they came back and said, listen, we'll really think about it, you know. And it was with Graham Yost, who I'm such a huge fan of, and Tim Oliphant.
No, what would you say no at the beginning? Were you like, oh, it's a pilot? And
well, no, it was a pilot, and it was also, it was a character, at least on paper, that was I'm gonna say two dimensional, you know, that really kind of perpetuated this idea, this stereotype of Southerners being rednecks and stupid and racist, and that, you know, that is one part of that region of the country, as it is everywhere else in our country. And I just didn't want to participate because I'd done it before, you know, and I've done it. I've made, you know, I've had some really great experiences playing that guy.
Oh, I've way done it in the past.
Yeah,
because I'm from, you know, I'm from Tennessee, so I've way done it in the past.
Absolutely.
Too. It's like totally sell out the South. But in reality, you know, a lot of parts of the South are lovely and people are very hospitable and they're sweet and they'll, you know.
And extremely sophisticated and extremely world-wise and extremely well-traveled. Some of my favorite conversations, and I've had some, like yourself, some great conversations in my life. And if I look back on them, some of the seminal, most important conversations I've ever had are with artists who are from the South. You know, with a glass of wine, listening to Willie Nelson in a backyard with, you know, a fire pit in somebody's backyard in a suburban neighborhood. You know, you didn't build a fucking fire pit. Like you dig a fire pit, get a couple rocks and a shovel, dig that shit up, and get four pieces of wood. It's done. Conversation's on. And so I just didn't want to participate in that way. And then when we continued the conversation, I said, well, what if we make him this? And will you just let me do my thing with it? And they said, yeah, man, you know, go for it. And I had such a good time. I was just blown away by the whole experience. And it immediately, it felt like, you know, this is just a one-time thing, but this is something that I would, you know, want to kind of participate in. This is what I'm kind of looking for. And it was a character that I really felt that I could expand over time, and as fate would have it, I got the opportunity to do it, you know. And we're four. We have two episodes left in season four.
Wow.
And yeah, man, 11 years, mate. 11 years in television.
Well, and The Shield too was one of those shows that was a very pioneering show, and because, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, HBO did. And Showtime, like they did, as far as like quality cable programming, that you started to see, like, oh, okay, HBO, Showtime.
Yeah.
But, you know, with The Shield was one of the first, you know, like just like basic cable.
It was the first basic
where
cable,
people were like
13 hours.
Oh, fuck.
Programmed at television. And literally the only other one. Oz was on, I think, before even The Sopranos, but it was The Sopranos, which I think they had finished their first season, finished airing kind of their first season when we went to air, or when we were in the middle of our season or whatever, we getting ready to air. And that was it, you know, really, for this 13-episode paradigm. I'm sure there's so many people that are listening to this podcast that will say, you know what, that motherfucker doesn't know what he's talking about.
Well, that always happens.
And, yeah, of course.
And that's always going to happen.
For all those people, I'm sorry.
It's always going to happen.
You know, I think that that it was really the Sopranos and then The Shield right behind it. You know, we were at the forefront of this 13-episode serialized character arc story paradigm. And now it's just, you know, it's just taken off like wildfire, and thank God for it, because the content on television is so fucking good, man. The actors are so good, and I'm just so grateful that I've been able to kind of touch it, you know, and kind of be there in some ways since kind of the beginning, and it's been good.
But also, you know, I think it's a good lesson for anyone, because I don't know how anyone is just an actor. That to me sounds terrifying.
Vacuous and yeah.
Terrifying.
In what way terrifying?
Terrifying in
like
the sense that
paying your bills, like how the fuck am I gonna,
well, sure.
I'm an actor.
Paying your bills, but basically you're also, you know, it's like I was always, my whole life I was always going to do stand up because I love comedy.
Yeah.
But the other thing about it that was satisfying to me was that no one could tell me when I could do the thing that I wanted to do. So with acting, yeah, you can go to classes or you can do, you know, you can do theater, you know, so you can kind of, you can keep that running. But if you really want to act in film and television as well, you can't just do that. You have to wait until someone says, you look right for this and your reading is good. And so you should come in and do this. And so it's to sit around and wait to be chosen is so... I just get anxiety thinking about it. Yeah. And I hated when I just went on auditions. And
but did you have that in comedy? I mean, you have to get permission from like a comedy club, like a comedy club to kind
you
of
go do.
Up on stage?
I mean, yeah, you do. Yeah. I mean,
once you start building your reputation, how does that work?
Well,
did you start in Tennessee? I'm sorry. I'm going to ask.
No. Ask me whatever you want. No, I'm in Tennessee. I lived in Memphis. My family moved around a lot, but I lived in Memphis up until freshman year of high school.
Wow.
My parents had split up. My mom remarried. My stepdad and my mom, we moved to Denver for 2 years. I went through my junior year in Denver.
Cold.
Much colder. Although Denver is not as bad as, like, you know, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah.
But it's a lovely city. Senior year of high school, stepfather gets a job offer in Los Angeles. We moved to L.A. I stay here. I go to UCLA. So and that's, you know, that whole time I was obsessed with comedy since the 70s. And then in college, I start toying around with stand-up. There was a comedy group there, and so I started doing stand-up. And so that's where it started. That's where it started for me. I did not start doing – there's no stand-up in Memphis that I can find.
Right.
There's not really a stand-up. Like some cities have good stand-up karma.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Georgia's great. You know, you have Caroline's there. You have Laughing Skull there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but the oh my god, what was it called? The Punchline.
Yeah.
Back in the day when I had my fake ID, it was like where I would take pretty ladies to impress them, right? Because I had a fake ID at like 15. And
really?
Yeah. Dude.
And it worked.
It worked.
Because you're a young looking guy, so
you think I'm a young looking guy?
I do. You're a young looking guy with like
a
young
looking guy, man.
Why?
The forehead, something about the face just comes out. It's like I have a 3D, fuck, like a 6D face.
6D?
It like just comes into the fucking room, man. Like a good like 2 minutes before I walk in, you know? It's so fucking full.
Walton Goggins now in 6D.
Yeah. I don't, you think, I want to take that as a compliment.
Yeah, because I can't imagine, because when you were 15, you probably, I imagine that you probably looked 12 when you were 15.
I had a really good ID, man. I had a great fake ID, and my favorite name at the time was Garth Snyder. Isn't that weird, man? Like, because I met this guy named Garth, and I thought, man, that is the coolest fucking name.
So you had a fake ID made?
I had a fake ID. I mean, I didn't. Yeah, I had it made. Like they were, you know, like they're young capitalist.
Yeah,
you know, in every small town. And there was a day that he was going to be in my small town, and he reached out through like one of the cool guys to get like 20 people together, and you have to come up with the money, and we did it.
God damn it! See, that is a much better way. That's a much better way. Well, especially, well, in the 80s, there were still some places that still had like paper IDs, where the driver's licenses. I guess they were laminated at that point.
Yeah,
And not like credit
they were
cards.
Laminate. Yeah, they were laminated. But it was just the side of a fucking library.
God damn it! You know, because when I was in college, I mean, even after I turned 21, I still didn't look 21. I still looked, yeah. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
When you're young, that's the bane of your existence. Like, I'm older than, no, stop it. Stop it. I remember some girl when I was like 15, I asked her out and she sort of like, huh, you know, like she rubbed my face or something. I was like, you don't even shave yet. I'm like, why is that a prerequisite for fingering? I didn't say that. I wish I had. That probably would have caught her off guard. She would have been like, all right, let's make it happen. But as she would have said, I admire your moxie. But that no woman ever admired my moxie when I was growing up. But my fake ID was a hand-me-down from basically just a white guy. And so...
Just your average
white guy. And we looked nothing alike. I have very pointy features. He had very bulbous features. And I think the ID was like Matt Bellflower or whatever.
could be a Matt Belflower.
I could be a Matt Belflower.
You actually could be a Matt Belflower.
I could be a Matt or a Steve.
You could be a Matt or a Steve. Yeah. 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 Matt, Steve, Chris. Yeah.
And so the idea.
You are a Chris.
I am a Chris.
Wait a minute.
I could be a Chris. So it didn't work. I was afraid to use it. There was a hierarchy of bars in Westwood that I knew, like, they're tough on IDs. They're okay. So we went to this one place called Los Panchos, and everyone who worked there was Latino. And so I think that made it easier because we white people, like, culturally, a lot of us probably look very similar if you're not of our culture. I think it's just sort of a biological thing that we all have that – you know, that people of different I think it's a...
They so look at us and they all look the same.
We all look the same. Yeah.
Or maybe it was a guy who said, look, he just felt sorry for this, like, white punk.
That
just had a date and he just wanted a margarita.
I guarantee you the Latinos in Westwood did not feel sorry for the, for the white punks.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it was a shit show of obnoxious Caucasian college students like, fucking shit up. And not respecting an honest day's work.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, so two things, there was that. And then this bar was also kind of, it was kind of tucked away somewhere. So they were just a little looser. Like it was sort of hidden.
Yeah.
So they were looser with stuff. But I do remember one day they questioned it. And for some reason I argued it.
You did.
I was like, that is me. That is me. Here's the address. I'm from Santa Rosa, California. I come in here all the time. This is ridiculous. Like, I did the fucking classic white guy. This is ridiculous. Who do I need to talk to? It's like that fucking piece of shit guy.
Love that guy.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
They were like, all right, shut up.
Sorry,
go in.
Sorry, man. Sorry. Whoa, easy. Calm down.
But for $2, for $5, they had dollar beers, and they set all this amazing, like, homemade Mexican food out. And so you could feast on incredible food and get dollar beer. So for $5, you could get super buzzed and get and eat a lot of delicious Mexican
food. Like during those times where we had no money, you know, not like nothing. And I would, you know, meet my buddies out, and we would always go to Mexico. We would start at a Mexican restaurant, you know, same reason, because you could get like a pitcher of beer or whatever. And it was, they wouldn't let you sit at the table. Unless you were going to eat, you know, or they wouldn't let you kind of hang out in these kind of Mexican restaurants we went to back in Georgia. And so we were always so hungry, we were starving, but they wouldn't give you chips and sour cream unless you were going to have dinner. So our line was, you know, it's just two of us. We're meeting three other people. They're on their way. You know, they're coming. So we just really need some chips and some salsa and, you know, some sour cream and guacamole. That would be fantastic. We're not going to pay for it because it's part of the dinner.
right.
It's part of dinner. Like, you don't give chips. I mean, this is a Mexican restaurant. That's what you fucking do, man. Give me my fucking chips.
Where's my chips and salsa?
Yeah, and so we would start there, and as soon as we had filled up on chips for free, that was our dinner. We'd say, you know what? Our friends didn't come.
Oh, that sucks.
We told them the Rancho Grande on da-da-da.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was very, very
funny.
Well,
it's probably not hilarious to the restaurant. I think it's fun to sort of remember, because now it's so easy to get caught up in stupid shit where you're like, this one thing happened as a job, or that guy said that thing, or I didn't win this thing that I wanted, or I didn't get that thing. And when you really think back, like, I remember there was a place in Westwood called Headlines, and it was a fucking amazing burger joint.
Wow.
And if I would have to save up to feel comfortable, like, going there for a meal to get their burger special. If I could do that, like, the entire day was a win. I'm like, oh my God, I can go have this fucking burger and these curly fries and a shake that I love so much.
What was your first paid gig, man?
My first paid gig was as an adult. As a comic, or as a performer. It was a show called Trashed on MTV. Was my first paid gig.
Did you audition for that?
I did audition for it. Yeah, I auditioned for it. It was a fluke that I got, that they even had called me in, because I didn't have an agent or anything. They just, I'd been a contestant on another game show, and they were recycling their contestant pool. And then they were like, would you want to host this one show? Do you want to audition? Because you know, I had snappy white guy energy.
Yeah.
So.
A DJ, that's DJ energy.
DJ Energy is Snappy Wack Energy. Yeah, I guess I did have DJ Energy. I was like, early hey, on. You know, like fucking whatever. Like, you know, it's funny. I definitely have two separate. I was a super nerdy kid in school that was completely socially ostracized, but for some reason, instead of becoming afraid of people, it made me, I guess because of my obsession with stand-up comedy, it made me perform harder. And so I had no problem, like, you know, talking in public or being loud or being in people's faces.
Like, or did you kind of grow out of that, was there a period of time in kind of high school where you were really kind of quiet and kind of introverted and then you kind of.
No, I was always kind of obnoxious and I mean, it's sort of like, do you remember 16 Candles?
I love it.
Okay. So Anthony Michael, so Anthony Michael Hall's character, he's like, he's sort of the cocky, like he was nerd cocky.
Yeah.
And no one ever took him seriously, but in his mind, he was super.
Yeah.
I was that kid. So I was sort of like, he was like, I'm kind of like the king of the dipshits. Like, that's how I was in school. I was the one in my friend group who would say things to people, and everyone else was, you know, afraid to.
Wow. You were a leader. You were a leader.
I was, in a sense.
Looked up to.
But I couldn't, only because I would make shitty sarcastic comments at people that were horribly filthy.
Yeah.
I couldn't back it up with physicality or anything.
I think you could. I don't know. You may have some secret moves. You never know, man. There's something about thin, wiry guys.
You never know.
You never know, man. It's like still one of my favorite quotes from any song is, I don't know karate, I know crazy.
You know? What song is that?
That's James Brown.
Oh,
I don't know karate, I know crazy.
That's what white guys have on their side is the skinny white guy. You got to look out for him.
What's he hiding? Oh, yeah, but he's quick.
How were you in high school?
You know what? I was second runner up runner up most friendliest. Oh. Which I was fucking pissed off about. Which I got really fucking angry about.
Who are those cunts who made me fucking runner up for friendliness?
Second, dude. Second, really? I say hello to you motherfuckers every day.
Whose dick do I have to suck? Literally!
and then for that particular senior superlative or whatever, they did away with best dressed, which I was told I was a shoo-in. And then that particular year, they decided not to have that because they felt... You know, they didn't have it. It wasn't on the fucking sheet.
They're really testing your runner-up to friendliness award.
They really were, because I thought I had those two in the bag. And I was really pissed off. I went down and I said, what the fuck, man? You see this? You think I wanted to wear this fucking yellow jacket all year?
This is why you didn't win friendliest, Walton.
That's right. That's why I didn't win. So they said their reason behind it, which is, you know, there are less fortunate people that can't afford. I said, I am the less fortunate person. I'm that fucking dude. Half this shit comes from Burlington Goat Factory, but I'm rocking it, man. I'm fucking rocking it.
The Burlington Goat Factory.
Come on, buddy. I had I put beads on my, I broke down 15 of my mom's Mardi Gras beads and glued them on my socks in like the seventh grade to be like Michael Jackson. I had fucking the parachute pants and I would wear them with red underwear. Like I just kind of was that kind of guy.
You know what you are right now? You're a hipster for bedazzling. I was doing it before it was a thing.
That's funny. No, I had a lot of friends in high school, and there were a group of my boys, my guys. There were like five of us, and we were called the Fellas, and that was just us, the Fellas. And we had this thing, man. We had this thing. It was so fucked up. Where, you know, if within the five or six of us that were a part of this group, we would lie to other people, you know, we would kind of do fuck with other people. But if we were fucking with each other and someone really wanted to know the truth, like, hey, man, did you fuck my girlfriend? Did you come on to my girlfriend? Like when you were, even if you were drunk, did you come on?
Mm-hmm.
And if the other guy said, no, I didn't. And he would say, that's bullshit. Tell me the fucking truth, man. Did you say something to her? As long as you said FH, man. FH, Fellowship Honor.
Wow.
FH, I did not try to sleep
with
your girlfriend.
That's where you, that's the truth serum.
That was the truth serum. But it was all bullshit. Like, no one, everyone fucking, as soon as they were caught in a lie, they would just say FH, man. FH.
So the system
and
broke
still,
down.
You know, some of these guys are some, like my best friends today, man. I've known them for a very, very long time.
So the fellas are really, still together?
The band is almost together.
Okay.
We get together sometimes. We don't call ourselves the fellas anymore. Maybe the fogies. I don't know. You know, but
you know, you have 20 years before fogie status.
Yeah, we have 20.
You have 20 good years before official fogie status.
Yeah, but it was good. You know, I don't know if you get like this. I've always been this way though. I am an extrovert. I'm an introverted extrovert.
Uh-huh.
You know, I really enjoy people. I enjoy new experiences. I'm a very curious person. I like to expend a lot of energy and in every whether it's talking or whether it's listening.
You basically just described what took me 4 minutes to describe about myself in high school. You just condensed it with I'm an introverted extrovert. That's exactly what that was.
Oh, good.
That's what I was trying to get to, but you as a wordsmith have condensed it into two words where I was like, and then I would say so one day
the margarita in the Mexican restaurant.
One day I said this thing in front of people, but then other people, yeah, so introverted, extrovert. Yes, okay, perfect.
And so then therefore you balance that. At least I do. I have to balance my time with other people with my time alone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very, very important to me. I don't know that I could go out in the world and be engaging or really listen, like be the person that I want to be, unless I kind of have time to myself.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, I tell you, becoming I'm a father. Oh well, I'm that way at work.
Yeah.
I haven't eaten with the crew or my other actors. I haven't eaten lunch with people in probably 16 years. I go straight to my trailer. And that hour is kind of my time to go back down and to be very quiet, very zen, and I close my eyes. And it's just kind of my time in order to kind of go back out, you know? And that was one of my greatest fears about becoming a father. Because, so, hey, yeah, you just played with me. And now what, you want to go fucking you want to go read a book?
Like, man, come on, man.
What the fuck are you doing, man? No one else is here. I'm hungry, dude.
Do you know who you're talking to? I was runner-up for friendliness.
Yeah, exactly. So it was hard. It was really kind of hard to get used to the fact that you're responsible for another human being and they're always there. So I've been able to really kind of modulate my energy expenditure.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a half brother.
Okay.
I have a half brother.
Did you grow up
younger.
With your half brother?
No, I didn't.
So you grew up as an only child?
Yeah, I was an only child.
Me too.
My parents were divorced since I was 3 years old.
Yeah.
Dad went this way. Mom went with me this way. And so, no, I was an only child. And yeah, so it's an only child syndrome.
It's an only child syndrome.
Which is fucking awesome. It's an awesome syndrome.
Well, it is. I mean, I don't know if it's always awesome for other people because I feel like I think only children, sometimes we feel entitled to things that people who are part of larger families are like, what do you mean you're going to go be by yourself? Oh, well, yeah. I just need my time. Well, fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be a part of this group. No, I need, you know, like, we grew up and we're sort of conditioned to feel like it's all about us.
Yeah. Well, what's you know, the flip side of that, it's not like just entitled to, it's I can be by myself. And with you know certain women that I've been with, they're very uncomfortable with that. They're like, well, what do you mean you can go? You're just gonna go like to a movie by yourself? You're gonna go on vacation like for 6 weeks by yourself?
See, I think
you're gonna do like yeah. Oh,
all
yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
I think I've done that to. That's fine. I've done that to my current girlfriend, but on the other side, I don't. I think that's. Yeah, I'm the dude who does that. Where she's like, I think I'm just gonna go to the desert for a couple of days. I'm like, by yourself.
So you're not a true introvert extrovert. No, you are. But that's a part of. I love it, man. I really go away when I travel. Like if I'm doing it for myself, I take off for 6 weeks by myself.
Oh wow.
Yeah, I'm out, man. I'm done, and I'll communicate with you know a few people now by email. You know, well then by email too. But not by phone. I'd leave my phone at home and just take off.
What are these words you're saying to me? Leave your phone at home? Come on.
Come on. Come on. Do you have your, how close is your phone to you at all times?
It's right here. Where is it? Where's my phone? Oh, there it is. Give it to me. Give me my phone.
Damn it.
That got outside the 3-foot radius bubble.
For dinner? What's your etiquette for like conversation at dinner? Is phone on the table?
Well, when the girlfriend and I are going out, I just put the phone on the table just because it's lumpy in my pocket.
Yeah,
so I'll just take it out and set on the table.
Yeah.
But I do know that, if it's someone that I'm really comfortable with and, I'll sort of check, but if it's not, if it's someone that I don't, that's new or that I'm trying to, I certainly won't have my face in my phone. I mean, you look around a restaurant now and you just see a bunch of people doing.
Fucking everywhere, man. Yeah. Everywhere. Are you like a self-acclaimed kind of nerdist? What does that mean for computer accoutrements? Do you have the new small iPad?
The iPad Mini? Yeah.
iPad Mini?
Yeah. I do.
You answer that.
Yeah.
The iPad Mini? Yeah.
I have that.
I
just like gadgets and toys, and I've always liked gadgets and toys. And
do you carry, is there a series of things you carry with your, wow. Wow, that's a big bag. I mean, look, he's not the only one with a man purse. I'm telling you right now.
There's a MacBook Air here.
There's a MacBook
Air. Here's the iPad Mini right here.
iPad Mini.
Here's a little Kindle.
Little Kindle.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, there's a little Kindle. And then, of course, the front of the bag has all of the cables that charge or tether these things. Here's a fun thing that I'm going to start playing with, which is it's a moleskin that works with Evernote, which is a note-taking program. So basically, you can write your notes in here, and you photograph your notes, and then they become searchable text.
No.
Yep.
What? That is a moleskin. That is a moleskin. A writing pad, a moleskin writing pad.
They call it a smart notebook.
So then, can you erase on that smart notebook?
No. It's not like that. It's not like digital ink.
Okay.
It's a notebook. You're writing like apes have done for years.
Yeah.
But you can just photograph the notes and then it
paper that digitizes.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. You photograph the notes and then you can import those into Evernote and then the front. Well, now my bag is kind of like a purse because I've been staying at my girlfriend's a lot lately. So toiletry bag, of cables, tons of charging cables in here.
Yeah.
And then the front of the bag is a medicine cabinet because I travel a lot. So you got your Imodium in there if you need it, your Pepto.
Yeah. Do you do a little Lunesta? Do you do like any, with all your traveling?
Lunesta?
Like a sleeping
pill? The sleeping pill you take in moth form? I just imagine you basically just get this film of these moths that you pull off, these Luna moths, and you just, they dissolve on your tongue and you go right to sleep. No, I can't take anything because it, I'm too sensitive.
Can you sleep on a plane? Can you sleep on
totally.
A plane?
Totally.
You can. You're out. Are you a good sleeper in general?
No.
I'm a fucking great sleeper.
You're a very lucky man.
I'm a very lucky man. Like to the point where like, with and I've always kind of done this, but with my wife at night, kind of when we're talking, there will be a point where I'll say, "Honey, I've got 10 seconds left. 9, you gotta finish it up. 8, I'll count it down." And I've literally like say 3, 2, 1, "I love you. Good night." Turn over and I'm out and I'm done.
That's
like
amazing.
That
I can fall asleep okay, but I do find if I'm gonna get plagued with anxiety. It's between the hours of 4 and 5:30 in the morning.
That's a tough
where I will wake up
period of time.
I will wake up after 4 hours of sleep or so and just be like, what if I have cancer? My brain is trying to process something.
Yeah.
I think there are hormonal things that have to do with circadian rhythms that affect anxiety that at that time of your sleep pattern, it's just right there.
Yeah.
It's the worst. Anxiety is way worse at night.
Can you go back to sleep after that?
Sometimes I will have to get up for a little bit to distract myself, so I'll go up and do a little bit of work. A lot of the early Nerdist stuff was built on nighttime anxiety. So I would get up in the middle of the night and write just to be able to go be tired to go back to sleep.
Wow.
So people would get emails from me. They were like, do you ever sleep? Because you could get an email from me at 9 p.m. or 6 a.m. or 3:30 in the morning. Or,
wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Are he you, has a problem. Chris has a problem.
What are you talking about? Like, everything's
like your
fine.
Your friends are like, yeah, what? No, he has a problem. No, these emails are coming in all over the
what
place.
What is he doing?
What is going on with this guy?
I think he's a murderer. Only murderers are up at those hours. Do you? How's your? Is your wife cool with if you go? I need to go away by myself for a while.
Yeah. She is. She, you know what? She's.
Is she like good?
Been,
go.
Yeah. She's no. She's like, you know, really kind of understands. It's kind of part of who I am. And but it's obviously changed. You know, having a child, and because I don't want to be away. I don't want to be away from him.
Yeah.
Know, for that long. So I've gone away for work and. I was away. I've been kind of away for the last couple of years, man. Really, you know, other than doing the show.
Where's Justified shoot?
We're here. That's in Los Angeles. But as soon as we kind of wrapped, you know, luckily I've been in a position to kind of take off and do a movie, and it's hard because they haven't gone with me yet. Because he's, you know, I mean, he is his age, and he just is so into his routine. And I just kind of come home like every weekend or every kind of couple of weekends, really kind of regardless of where it is in the country. I just hop on a plane. But I'm going to take a trip this year somewhere, yet to be determined, for 3 weeks. I'm going to go for 3 weeks, and I can't. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm excited about it.
I think when you do go off on the mini sabbaticals, you have to say something really obnoxious like, "You can't cage a lion, baby," and then just walk out. And then, of course, you have to peek your head back in and be like, I love you.
I love you. I love you very much.
I love you.
I'll call every day. I'll have it on me.
I love you so much. Neck. Oh, my God. Please don't leave me. If you ever left me, I'd fucking kill myself. This lion would eat himself. This lion would eat out his own fucking dumb lion art for you, baby. Do you want me to chew it out now? I'll fucking chew it out right now. Oh, my God. I can't be without you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
that's my new bit, Codependent Lion. Thing's going to be really big this year. It's a new character. I think just in the last handful of minutes we have in the podcast, I would love to.
This one went by really, really fast.
I know.
Can I say that?
I know.
Like really quick.
It just flies by.
Yeah.
Because
you're a great conversation. Stop.
We're just having a conversation.
We're having a conversation.
We're just having, you know, like this is.
We really are. There was no. I have to say this for all your listeners. I'm sure other people have said this. There was no conversation with Chris before this sit down. There was no agenda. There were no questions.
We decided as soon as you showed up, we're going to just do the catching up on the podcast.
Yeah. It's very cool.
It's nice.
And I have your number now.
You have it.
Like in the instructions, text Chris.
You could just call me whenever you wanted and we could go and, you know, you don't have a lot of time either, but because now you have a family, but you know, you're certainly welcome to. If you're having lunch one day, just shoot me a text, and if I'm free, we'll come have lunch.
Deal.
Of course, we'll have to record it because conversations aren't worth having.
Maybe we should do this, man, honestly.
Okay.
We need to get together, and if you can't find your old fake ID, let's just make a new one with the same name.
And see if it works.
Flower, and go to a Mexican restaurant.
They're going
to
be very
or
hard.
Let's do this. Let's do the next evolution of fake IDs.
Okay.
You and I.
Yeah.
Are going to create our own fake IDs.
Okay.
Saying that we are over 65 and go to the Arclight and see if we can get us a new discount.
Okay. So I will be Matt Belflower and you're
Garth Snyder.
Garth Snyder.
I'm going to go 66.
Are we going to make ourselves up in any way? Like,
we should come up with new names, man. We should just do it. We should create like whole new identities and go in it like, you know, I may go for 80.
What? No, that's
even. No, I'm going to go 66.
Now
right?
You're just, yeah, 66.
Yeah.
I mean, 66 is not 66 plausible to begin with. 80 is like, come on.
But if we are as emphatic as you were in that Mexican restaurant, we're like, it's me, man. If we do the white guy argument, it's me. But that is me in that ID.
But here's, you know how that's going to backfire?
How?
They're not going to question it. We're going to be like, do I look 66? Like, it's going to backfire so hard. You know this is fake, right? And then we'll be telling them, we're doing a bit. We're clearly not 66. Yeah. No, it looked fine. What do you mean it looked fine? Fuck
that's
you.
That's right. Yeah. We'll walk into the theater. Was that $2 really worth it? To feel this way?
I just feel bad now.
You know, you look good, though, Chris. All right, man. I should get out of here, man. This has been a real pleasure, buddy.
This was fun. I want to have you, you know, you got to come back on because I would love for you to talk a little bit about the idea of, this is sort of where I was going earlier about not just being an auditioner, where you said, I'm going to make my own stuff so that I, you know, I mean, there's something about, you know, a certain type of person will say like, I'll try it the system's way, but then I'm also going to do my own thing as well.
Yeah. 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 And we, you know, we did that because we didn't want to wait around for that phone call anymore. That wasn't enough. Or in some ways it was, we kind of didn't think about it either in the sense that I think creative people create. It's what they spend their day doing. I can't really walk through my house without repositioning a pillow or looking at, like, I have these things, these tablescapes, you know, that are kind of all over my house.
Tablescapes.
I don't really watch a lot of
tablescapes
sports,
with Walton Goggins.
That's kind of what I do. And I'm constantly fidgeting with things because I like pretty things. I like to see visually, to be stimulated by the things are around me. And I think the same thing kind of applies to, you know, to my life in other areas. And that was when we got the opportunity to do this, and we reached out to friends to raise the money to do the short film. It was in $50. It was like a Kickstarter before a fucking Kickstarter.
Yeah,
you know, that's what you do. You reach out to people that believe in you. And it was from, you know, $5,000 here, or, you know, $500 here, or $100, whatever it is. And we had these investors, and then they believed in us and what we were doing, and we went out and made this movie. And it was not a question, really, that we were going to make another one, however long it took us to do it. So I spent really the next 8 years. I would do another movie if it was, you know, short and I was asked to do it. But I spent really my entire time on The Shield doing a season of the show and then going into, you know, one of our own movies or
wow.
You know, prepping. And it was, you know, it was just an extraordinary experience.
That's really fun. And
it really was.
What did you learn as a producer? How did that inform your performance? Like, how did it inform your approach to acting?
Well, you wear every hat when you're making an independent film. You know, from craft service to sound to gripping to you just do what needs to be done in order to get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a great understanding and a great respect for all the artisans that we work with on a daily basis. I know how hard they work. And because I've been up close with them and stayed just as long as they have. And also as a producer, you have a real understanding of what those things fucking cost. So that has really kind of like, I see whenever I work now, I don't just see it from my own kind of narcissistic singular perspective. I really see it from everyone's perspective and mm-hmm. understand kind of the DP and his agenda and the cameraman and his agenda and the grip and his agenda. Like, I really kind of see it from you know, multiple angles. And I also, it's debunked the myth, like that the emperor has no clothes, that what we do is some great mystical kind of experience, that you have to go to the mountaintop and it's for a select group of people. No, it's not. My fucking kid is a better actor than most of the people working today. You know, I see it. It's like he says, I'm having tea. No, you're not, mate. That's a stick. That's a stick
in your
hand. You
should not be drinking a stick.
And like literally he will touch a pine cone as if it's hot water, like hot water in a can, and pull his finger back and scream. Like that's the power of imagination. And that's what we all have. That's where we all come from as human beings. So to do that for a living always really scared me. Even when I would get work, when I was working, it scared me because I thought it was an experience that maybe Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, you know, and insert icon here get to experience. I would never really get to experience that. But you know, making these movies and understanding that no, this is a fucking shot. We need to get this shot and then move on, gave me permission to give myself permission to go. No, you can access it.
Yeah,
you can access it right now, right here, and that's, you know, been one of the greatest liberating experiences of my life, and I'm just so grateful for it. And the other thing that it's taught me to do and given me confidence to do is my belief in myself when it comes to story. I'm not a writer. I'm a very good editor. I'm a very, very good editor. I understand story. I understand what people are trying to say in their story, and I'm able to be over their shoulder or if asked to give them advice, whether they take it or not. It's a perspective that my close friends really respect, and that feels really good. And I couldn't have done that without kind of making these movies. And I'm not done. You know, I have a television show that I've been working on with a friend of mine, and we've sold it. And
congratulations!
Yeah, and we sold my partner and I sold another one that he actually did. That went on to make, that's coming on the Sundance Channel. It's the first original scripted programming on the Sundance Channel.
What is it called?
Rectify.
Okay.
And I was kind of attached to be the lead to it, but it didn't happen at AMC, so I took Justified, and now it's on at the Sundance Channel, and it's something that's very, very special. So, man, I hope to be directing a movie maybe even this summer.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So it's a part of my life now. And it's just a fluid kind of way to create.
This has been a wonderful catch-up chat with you.
It really has been.
Thank you so much for coming in.
We're just kind of building from here. This is really kind of the conversation that we never really had.
Not in 13 years.
That's right, man.
Well, then a lot of the blanks wouldn't have been filled in yet. So yeah. There was a lot to catch up on, but let's absolutely hang out just as socially as
fake
people having a conversation.
Fight. It's a real pleasure to see you.
It's good to see
you,
Walton Goggins. You too. Man. Congratulations.
All right, man.
We're gonna have another awkward hug.
Oh, enjoy your burrito.
Really weird.
Oh, good God, hug.
It's a little too hard.
Let it go. Just release it a little bit. Just breathe. Just breathe.
You're still activating your pecs. I'll let my abs go.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Whatever your legal document needs, LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more, they've got it. Over 12 years and 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom. Start your business or protect your family today at LegalZoom.com using the offer code Nerdist.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!